Yeah, I would like to thank the organizers for having me and giving me this opportunity to speak about this work. For the past couple of weeks, we have had quite a bit of MBL, so this is sort of a break from the MBL team, I guess. So I'll be talking about dynamic nuclear polarization, and this was a work done by collaborators who are all at Harvard. Some of them have moved on, so this was done motivated by experiments done in Amir Yacoubi's group several years now. And the experiments I'll be talking about in more detail is done by John Nickel, who was a postdoc at Harvard, now is an assistant professor at Rochester. Shannon Harvey was a grad student at Harvard, and Michael Schulman, who was a Harvard grad student, now has moved on to data science. And the theorists on this project are the Bert Halperin and Manuel Rajpa. So to start off, I'd like to take a sort of a historical perspective on the DNP. DNP was first predicted, the fact that you can transfer the polarization of the electron spins to a nuclear spin bath by Oberhauser in 1953 in a paper studying sort of metals. And he presented it at sort of the ABS March meeting as a contributed talk, which was chaired by Purcell. And it was sort of met with quite a lot of skepticism at that time. I mean, there were Felix Bloch, Rabi, Purcell himself, Ramsey, they were all sort of, they did not quite believe this argument. And with time, it was shown that it was correct, what he had predicted, that you can actually use the nuclear the electrons to transfer polarization from the electron spins. And it's sort of interesting, I found it interesting in his obituary in the Department of Physics at Purdue. There are sort of letters written between Oberhauser and Ramsey, sort of going back and forth about this idea in the early days of dynamic nuclear polarization.
How long did it take these guys to give in?
It was quite soon, actually. Ramsey was supposedly the reviewing the paper, and for a summer he sat over it. Suppose the arguments were which sort of stumped these people were based on how sort of thermodynamics works, because it was very non-intuitive, because you're cooling the nuclear spin bath, which is at a very high temperature, with electron spins, which are at very low temperatures. So they were not really convinced that that could exist as an equilibrium state, like you can polarize, transfer the polarization, and that they thought it was a metastable state. And so Ramsey went back and talked to everyone else, and then eventually they were convinced, and the paper was published in Physical Review and was not rejected, which Ramsey in his letter actually states. So I was glad that I was not the one who rejected that paper. So it's a sort of acute, now this field is very big, it affects chemistry, biology, and a lot of other things, but it sort of originated in solid state physics, which is it's an interesting perspective. So let me jump ahead, jump into sort of more recent experiments. This is already 20 years old, more than 20 years old. It was done in sort of two-dimensional electron gases. In semiconductor heterostructures. So these are also gallium arsenide. So this is sort of integer quantum Hall regime. You have these, this is a device with two quantum point contacts, and you have the two edge states. And so they tried to study the edge transport, the transport as you sweep the gate voltage. You have a gate voltage at this terminal 1 and terminal 2, you draw current out, and you measure the DIDV, the differential conductance of this sort of device. And they found that as you sweep across this voltage range, you produce a sort of a hysteretic effect, because the electron spins transporting through the edge channel are coupled to the sort of underlying nuclear spin bath, and this the spin flips that happened across these two channels are mediated by the nuclear spins. And as you go across, you sort of polarize the nuclear spins. And now if you do this in the same sample, same run, you sort of ramp back the voltage. There is a sort of a hysteretic effect in the sense the nuclear spins are in a different configuration. So for them to sort of equilibrate, for the electron spin to now equilibrate across the channel, sort of it sees a different nuclear spin configuration, and that sort of gives rise to a sort of hysteretic effect in the sort of the edge transport. And this was understood in terms of sort of dynamic nuclear polarization in these experiments back then. There are now more recent experiments. This is phosphorus doped silicon. So you have this phosphorus dopant. This is a different set of experiments that was sort of trying to study transport. This is more quantum coherent effects. These were experiments actually done in Oxford itself. John Martin was at Oxford when these were done. So this is phosphorus doped silicon, the wave function of the phosphorus atoms sort of delocalized over several sites. What they were able to show, the nuclear spin nuclear spins are at very high temperature, so they're basically unpolarized. But what they were able to show by microwave driving the electronic degree of freedom, you can produce a state which is an entangled state of the electron and the nuclear degree of freedom. So you can produce, they were able to actually, by transferring the polarization, in this microscopic degrees of freedom, and they were able to measure the density matrix, the two-spin density matrix of the electron and the nuclear spin in these systems, and that density matrix sort of had it's a measure of entanglement. Some purity of the density matrix satisfied certain bounds, which showed that the state between the electron and the nuclear spins were entangled. So there is
this system. So what is the lifetime of the spin?
So it's seconds. So this is even there to silicon, and the silicon itself has pretty long lifetime. I mean,
dominant relaxation process. So is it because of nuclear, or is it?
I think doesn't play a role in silicon. It's like I think phonons. Yeah, it's phonons and spin orbit. That's right. So interestingly, some people are actually trying to use these kinds of systems to make qubits. I mean, there is an effort, solid-state qubits, to move towards silicon because they have naturally very long lifetimes. While if you are affected by nuclei in gallium arsenide, the lifetimes are shorter and you have to work quite a bit harder to get longer coherence times in these qubits in gallium arsenide. Yes. So let me now, this was sort of two different experimental systems where dynamic nuclear polarization, one is sort of from the point of view of quantum transport, the other is from the point of view of entanglement, sort of plays an important role. So now let me go to the experimental setup that I'll be sort of talking for the rest of my talk, is a double quantum dot. So here you have sort of it's a cartoon picture of a heterostructure, semiconductor heterostructure. So you have a two-deck, which is here, which is buried around 100 nanometers below the surface. So you can deplete the two-deck by bottom gate, applying the bottom grid. And then there are sort of these metallic gates which are etched onto the surface of this sort of semiconductor wafer. And these gates, you can control the voltages on these gates. You can trap two electrons. So here is sort of a cartoon of the two electrons which are trapped by the gate voltages. And there's a third quantum dot which is used as a sensor to measure the qubit. So you sort of use another quantum dot to measure the state of these two electrons by adjusting the voltages on these leads. Here it's depleted. So green means there's no electrons. The red means there is a sort of electron fluid in these leads, and these are sort of these regions are controlled by the electrochemical potentials created by these gates, which are on the surface. And there is a lot of stuff going on in between. There could be sort of random impurities which sort of produce noise, charge noise, which I will come to a little later on, which make measuring detailed properties of the qubit difficult. So these are sort of the kind of practical sort of difficulties in studying the states of this qubit. So your sensor, as I said, there's a sensor dot just to measure the state of this qubit by passing by measuring the current through these so dots and yeah, by adjusting the power gates. So
let's see. If you, I mean, so is it just hyperfine interaction between this, or what's the
what?
Is it the hyperfine interaction?
So there is hyperfine interaction. So there is.
I don't understand the effect yet. I mean, so even with all this background, I sort of missed the. What's the Hamiltonian?
I'll write down the Hamiltonian. Okay. So here is the Hamiltonian. That was just. I mean, in a couple of slides, you'll see what I mean. So let's try to write down the Hamiltonian for the two electron system. So you have 0,2 and 1,1 states. So 0,2 will be singlet, and the 1,1 when the chemical detuning, the voltage detuning between the two dots is high. So epsilon is positive. So both the electrons, the ground state is a singlet. So this is the 0,2 singlet. And when they are comparable, then you can sort of start mixing in the 1,1 triplet and the singlet states at sort of negative detuning. So 0,2 and 1,1 singlet get split by the tunneling, the exchange interaction. So this state and this state are sort of admixtures of 0,2 and 1,1 singlet. And then there's the triplet sector. And the triplet sector, if this the triplet plus and triplets minus, if they are spin conserving terms, then they don't talk to anything. But the triplet zero state at large detuning, because the spin is the same as a singlet, they are split by some energy gap. And this energy gap is this is the sort of triplet zero and the singlet state, the energy gap here. And that is given by some exchange interaction, which is just T square over U kind of term. So it's split. So the singlet and the triplet zero has some sort of energy difference, which is given by the tunneling between the two. While the up down and the down up state. There's a uniform magnetic field which splits the triplet zero triplet sector. So there's a large magnetic field. So we are only interested in this singlet and the triplet zero sector. And that Hamiltonian is basically given by this. There's the tunneling matrix element. The splitting between singlet and triplet zero due to the tunneling. And then there is a difference in magnetic field of the two dots, which splits the up down from the down up. So this difference in magnetic field can be produced by the nuclear spin configuration. So if you have these nuclear spins, which are sort of in this lattice under the dot, it produces an effective magnetic field. And if the effective magnetic field between the two dots is different, that produces the off-diagonal term in this singlet-triplet basis. So you can produce this difference in magnetic field using different variety of methods. You can put in a sort of magnet, molecular small magnet between the two dots, but you can also produce it by generating a nuclear field gradient. And this is what is done in experiments in Amir's group. So these two terms in the Hamiltonian gives you a control of the qubit over two different axes. One is given by the J term, the exchange interaction. The other is given by sort of the gradient and the magnetic field. Now, and this gradient in the Overhauser field. So now what governs, this nuclear bath is some very high temperature. And how can one create a gradient a sort of a non-equilibrium sort of distribution of the nuclear spins across a nanometer length scale, so 100 nanometer length scale. And that's the challenge in experiments, how to create this magnetic field gradient and maintain that over the time scale of the operation of the qubit, so that you can you can change the states on the block sphere. So Amir's group has sort of developed the expertise to pump the nuclear spins and create these non-equilibrium distributions of the nuclear spins, and even to reduce the fluctuations in the, because if these terms are fluctuating, which way they very well might be, because it's sort of a many-body quantum system, then this term is fluctuation, and this leads to decoherence in the qubit. So this is one of the limiting decoherence factors which hampers this gallium arsenide double dot qubits. So I will talk. So the rest of the talk will be about studying these sort of dynamic properties between this double dot system and its sort of nuclear spin environment. And trying to develop a theoretical picture of the experimental observations, some of the experimental observations. So this is another experiment, also in Amir's group. So this is probability distribution of this delta BZ nuclear. Delta, this is a difference in the nuclear field between the two dots. And by pumping, they have a specific pumping protocol where they are able to sort of narrow this distribution of the nuclear spin substantially. And that, you can immediately see, improves the coherence of the nuclear spins. So by pumping the electronic states, so this is, so you create a nuclear electronic state in this singlet branch. So this is, these are the three triplet states. And this is this triplet plus singlet crossing. And this crossing will be split by spin orbit interaction, by spin orbit and the nuclear spins, because those are the terms which do not conserve spin. So they will they will split this, and by driving the electron spins back and forth between these two levels, the singlet and the triplet branch, you are able to pound the nuclear spins in a particular direction. If you choose the protocols appropriately, the nuclear spins will be pumped, that their distribution becomes narrow, the distribution in their sort of magnetic, effective magnetic field.
Could you explain the essence of the effect? Because so what creates nuclear polarization? So is it flip of electron spin or?
Flip of electron spin.
So you have to flip it.
Flip electron spin. So the net spin of the system is conserved. Maybe I should have written down that. So there is net spin of this, the spin of the system is conserved, and the hyperfine interaction has a flip-flop term between nuclear and the electron spin. And every time you flip electron spin, a nuclear spin has to be flipped somewhere.
I see. So then you prepare electron spin again. So it's a very slow process, right?
You can pump the electron very fast. I mean, the nuclear doesn't change. The nuclear system doesn't change on that time. But the electron system, you can operate in nanosecond timescales. It takes tens of nanoseconds to go back and forth here.
So to create a single nuclear spin flip, so that takes, what is the time scale?
Every time you go across, and if you flip the electron state, you go into a triplet electron state, then you measure whether you got a triplet or not. Because that you can measure if the triplet, the transport through the dot changes. And every time the transport dips, you say, oh, the electron, there's a nuclear spin flip. And that's a probability, that depends on the strength of the hyperfine coupling. That depends on the strength of the hyperfine coupling. And that, I mean, the Landau-Zener probability for that, we can control. You can have a Landau-Zener probability of electron spin flip as high as 0.4. I mean, it depends how you're sweeping, how this is sweep rate across this gap. I mean, it's across this. So there's a small gap here, which is of the order of I would say some micro EV scale, micro EV scale, and that depending how fast you sweep through that, you can flip electron spin. It's just Landau Zener. And every time you flip electron spin, that means that the nuclear spin must have flipped somewhere.
Can I ask you, my your question. This S and T refers to the electronic spin signature. What does the plus minus zero, they indicate the...
This is a triplet, polarized negative direction, and triplet zero.
I mean, polarized in the sense for the nuclear spin?
No.
Just M component.
Just
the M component.
Yeah.
Okay.
These are just
the triplet you have this is the electronic triplet.
It's electronic
the,
triplet.
The plus minus indicates the polarization.
Yeah, polarization.
So that doesn't tell the nuclear spin mission.
But every time the electronic state flips, you know that the nuclear spin must have flipped.
Okay.
So because there is no spin orbit interaction. Yeah, exactly. So I will talk about that. The spin orbit can mess this up. So if there's spin orbit, even though if it's weak, if it's comparable to the hyperfine, then every time you flip, it could be due to a spin orbit turn in the Hamiltonian.
So in practice, how fast should you be doing it? Sub-efficient?
So there's also charge noise. So I think there is a sort of a sweet spot where you if you go fast enough. You can tune off the spin-orbit interaction, essentially. The spin-orbit interaction, if you orient the dots correctly, if it's fabricated on this, on the system in the right orientation, and if you apply the magnetic field in the appropriate direction, that's the next slide, you can turn off spin-orbit. Then the entire effect is essentially a hyperfine interaction. So that was, for a long time, they were experimentally able to pump and create these large magnetic field difference, like of the order of gigahertz. I mean, the magnetic field difference, you can operate the qubit at 100 megahertz, gigahertz kind of times, sort of frequency scales. But it was unclear what was the physical mechanism which helped them do that. So by they had aligned the dot in such a way that the spin orbit was canceled. And the pumping was more efficient that way.
So I also missed, what is epsilon? What is the pumping parameter?
Oh, this is just the chemical potential. Okay, this is this, the detuning.
The imbalance?
The chemical, the potential difference between the two levels.
Is that tuned by the magnetic field?
This is just gate voltage.
But it's also, you have another picture, can you go back one slide? It's in a, Zeeman turn, it's a function of the E. Yeah. The G mu B.
So this is the magnetic field produced by the nuclear spins.
On the graph, the energy diagram is G mu.
Yeah, so there is this magnetic field which splits the triplet sector.
That's splitting. Just the same. You also move.
That's indicating the split, not the function is the epsilon.
No. So this is linear because it's plotted in a particular way, but it shouldn't. Yeah, I mean there's no epsilon. Went through it a bit too quickly.
So and the spin diffusion. So once you've created your spin polarization, how long does it persist for?
So that can be of the order of tens of seconds, even minutes, I would say. Relaxation time, the T1 time is very long. That's T1, essentially, right?
Is it T1 or is it spin diffusion? Because nuclear spins cannot give away their polarization, right?
Yeah. It's a slow process. So I think that may depend on the experiment and what you're measuring. You are not directly probing spin diffusion. I mean, it's some proxy for spin. I mean, it'll be some proxy for spin diffusion, and you see it in some signal in your electronic system. So depending what you're measuring in this electronic system, that time scale can, I mean, 2 pi's. There are 2 pi's. I mean, there are factors which may enter, which may. But I think it's of the order of seconds. my intuition.
Okay, yeah, sorry, Bozzy. Can I still try to get a model? You have the electron, it's on like quantum dot.
Yeah, two wells.
So the electrons, for the nuclear spins, you have a lot of nuclear spins?
Yeah, so this is...
Are they correlated already, or they just...
So they are at very high temperatures. The nuclear spin bar is at infinite temperature effect.
Okay.
I mean, in temperature, we don't know if they have equilibrated. But they are very, as I will show, experimental data suggests that they are very coherent. The nuclear spin bath is very coherent.
So how, what temperature can you pull up to?
I don't know how to measure, the temperature. I mean, the temperature when I'm saying is the energy scale of their interaction, I mean, of the nuclear energy scale versus the temperature of sort of the fridge, so to say. I mean that if it's an if I don't know how to measure the temperature of the nuclear spins.
Let's see, that's a different question, like which fraction of nuclear spins is polarized?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can measure the polarization, yeah. So polarization, okay. So I didn't get your question. So the polarization, even though the difference is large, polarization, you can pump so 10% polarization, 5-10%, I don't know the number very precisely, but I think it's of that order.
Zero, right? You're starting out like a zero polarization.
Zero polarization. I mean, infinite temperature means zero polarization. So I think you can pump it to pretty large polarizations. And that's pretty large, I would say. So this is a slide on this is how to tune the spin orbit interaction. So the spin orbit, so you have a magnetic field, in plane magnetic field. This is the dot, and this is the sort of the sensor dot. You can change the direction of the magnetic field in plane direction. And the spin orbit, effective spin orbit interaction, depend on the electrons in the dot. Is given by, it depends as a sine of this angle between the axis of the dot and this the direction of the magnetic field. So this is assuming the dot is in some plane of the semiconductor. There is Rajba spin orbit, Dresselhaus spin orbit. There are all those details. But effectively, if you take all those into account, the dependence of the angle of the magnetic field is sine phi. And this is very explained in great detail in this paper, where they do a microscopic calculation to get this dependence. So if the spin orbit, I will not talk in much detail about that, but if this, in the experimental paper, they have studied in great detail as a function of this psi angle, and they really see the pumping being governed, going into the spin orbit regime, you don't pump the nuclear spins. And that really inhibits the process. While if you align it in the right direction, then you shut down spin orbit and then you pump it better. So that is now very well understood. So let me now, in the sort of second half of the talk, focus on this part of the story, where. We are pumping between the S and T plus. So earlier I had shown that the qubit is made of S and T zero, T zero being SZ is equal to zero, triplet zero state of the two electrons. That's the two level system where the qubit is operated. But the pumping is done, as I said, in the S T plus sector, the two levels which are important for pumping the nuclear spin. So every time you go through these two levels, if you end up in this branch, that means your spin flipped electron spin, and this is the deuterium, which is the sort of chemical voltage difference between the two dots. And what in experiments, what is basically measured is this probability. And so you create a state, you go to this misaligned state, and you create a singlet. And you drive the chemical potential across this anti-crossing, and you measure whether you get a singlet or a triplet. And this gives you a measure. You can measure this power PLZ versus the sweep rate. So you can control how you're sweeping. And that gives you an estimate of this gap, delta ST. And this gap is given by the spin orbit and the nuclear hyperfine. So that you can estimate the strength of the nuclear hyperfine without putting in any parameters by doing this experiment. And the fit gives a good estimate of what this gap is between the singlet and the triplet plus sector. You load, you sweep through, then you read out. That gives you a probability, and that gives you, as a function of the sweep rate, that gives you the gap. So this is a plot of that. So measuring delta ST. So you load, as I said, and you sweep across. This is sort of the dotted line is the ST plus anti-crossing. You sweep across this, then you jump back to measure the state. You ask whether it's a singlet or a triplet, and that gives you a probability. You do the run several times, and that gives you a probability, this probability as a function of sweep rate. So at small, at faster sweeps, you get some linear behavior. And as you go to slower sweeps, the equation says that you should go to 1. You should always transition. But in a physical system, you don't go to 1. You don't saturate to 1 because there's charge noise in these systems. So this lack of saturation to 1 is related to charge noise. That'll always be a problem in these systems, which we haven't quite understood. That's sort of like the theoretical, to theoretically treat the charge noise is a very challenging problem. You can treat the nuclear spins, understand them, because they are a slow degree of freedom. Nuclear spins don't evolve so much, so you can do the experiments in a way so that the effect of the nuclear spins can be controlled. But the charge noise is very difficult to control. So for the rest of the talk, I'll be focusing on one experimental protocol, which is a set of observations, and trying to describe those set of observations based on a simple-minded theory. So the experiment is you load in the 0-2 state, which is in this detuning, far detuned system, where both the electrons are in the singlet state, and you sweep across. And you sweep across and you jump back, and then you measure the state. You ask whether it's a singlet or a triplet. And this process is very fast. This is on the order of tens of nanoseconds. So it's a very fast process. During that time, the nuclear spins don't evolve much. The Larmor frequencies and the spin-spin interaction between the nuclear spins is sort of very slow. So on that time scale, it doesn't change much. But then you wait, you dump that electron, and you create the system again in the 0-2 singlet and do the process again. And you do it multiple times. You do multiple. There's a sequence of, in the experiment, they do 500 of these. And these are separated by 4 microseconds. So this is of the time scale of nanoseconds, tens of nanoseconds. And this is of the time scale of few microseconds. So there's a long time. And in between these sweeps, the nuclear spins have evolved. Larmor precession, interactions between them, the relaxation takes place. So by looking at the correlations, the goal would be to look at the correlations in the Landau-Zener probability across different sweeps which are separated at certain time intervals. So the experiment is, what you measure is this, call it chi p, which is a pth sweep. What is the measurement? You get a 0 or a 1. Either the state is a singlet, your current is low below a certain threshold or above a certain threshold, gives you 0 or 1. Or not. And then you measure correlation functions between them. And you get a string of zeros and ones, and that's a correlation function. That's what you measure experimentally. Then those are related to some theoretically calculated Landau-Zener probability. That we will calculate using some model. So Landau-Zener probability will be calculated. And that because of this probabilistic quantum stochastic effect, there is a background which is coming from just randomly flip. In the correlation function, there's some random flips coming from the Landau-Zener process. And then there's a frequency dependence. So here is a figure. This is the kind of figure we sort of aim to describe. So there's an experimental plot, which is the black line. So this is the power spectrum of these set of measurements. This is a frequency. This is frequency in kilohertz. And this is the Fourier transform of these correlation functions in time. So it's a power spectrum of the Landau-Zener probability of the electrons. And it has certain behaviors. So this has different number of peaks, and the peak has certain areas. And the position of the peaks predicted by our theory are given by these vertical lines. Those are predictions of the theory, where the peaks should lie. And the functional form of this function is also given by our theory. I'll tell you within what approximations and all that. So there's a functional form, and then there are some adjustable parameters to make it fit with the experimental data. So experimental data is the black curve, which and then the theoretical sort of fit with adjustable parameters is this maroon curve. And the vertical line is where the theory predicts the peaks should be. One is VSO is equal to zero, so so phi, as I showed you, is when the magnetic field is aligned, so that the spin-orbit interaction is shut down. And this figure is when there's a finite spin-orbit interaction. So this is the goal of the work, to describe this experimental data.
So that is, when you come back, you know, you sweep from the singlet to a triplet, then you come back fast, so then there's no xeno transition.
Whatever branch you go to, that's the idea. It's not adiabatic. You either go up, or whichever branch you are in, it's not.
You never lose back the polarization.
No, you don't lose back. Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's absolutely right. So it's a non-adiabatic. That's a non-adiabatic. So the model is, I have a two-level system. So this is microscopic details. So you have some wave function on the dots, right dot. And psi r is the wave function of the right dot, psi left is the wave function of the left dot, and you have two electrons, and you write down the wave function between them. And there's some admixture between 0-2 singlet, so this is 0-2 singlet, and this is a 1-1 singlet. So there's some admixture due to the tunneling, so the amount of admixture is given by some by the tunneling and the detuning between the two dots. And then there's a triplet state. That is this two-level system. It's microscopic. It's not so relevant for the purposes of this talk, but yeah, for other purposes, this is important. Then you can write down the Hamiltonian in this subspace where they are off diagonal. So this is in the ST plus subspace. They are off diagonal terms. And the off diagonal terms are exactly the nuclear hyperfrying and the spin orbit interaction. So this is the two-level system, and these terms are this nuclear hyperfine, which has this nuclear spins, and then there is this spin orbit, which can be varied by changing the direction of the magnetic field, and you sweep these sweeping the detuning as you're going through is essentially choosing a functional form of this energy difference between singlet and the triplet state. Some linear ramp in the experiment. So that's this is a classic Landau-Zener problem, but now we want the Landau-Zener our problem where there are these off-diagonal terms. So the off-diagonal terms, we know if the off-diagonal terms are static, then this is the Landau-Zener probability, and where you just, the gamma is basically beta is the sweep rate, and you have some a magnitude of this off-diagonal term, and you try to study as a function of sweep rate what happens. So now we write down the off-diagonal nuclear term, which is sum of bunch of nuclear spins. These are spin 3-half objects. And the nuclear spins are gallium-69, there's impurities, gallium-71, and arsenic-75. And they're different spin species, so that's why there are these different lambdas. And then there's this wave function term. You have to calculate the hyperfine interaction in the ST state. So this is where the ST form of the wave function goes in. It will not be important, but for the sake of completeness, I put it there. And there are these nuclear spin terms from different species. And what we will do is we will sort of do a semi-classical approximation where we will club all the spins of the same species into one collective degree of freedom. So this is like the central spin model where all the spins of the same species So you write down some wafers, some now this is a classical object, but it has some time dependence depending on the Larmor frequency of these of the species. So omega lambda is the Larmor frequency of the species because there's a magnetic field, so it precesses. And these quantities are essentially Gaussian random variables with a width which is fixed by the density of that species. So that it's given in gallium arsenide, you know very well what these densities are, and the hyperfine interaction strength. So the width of the probability distribution is given by parameterized by this quantity. And this is the off-diagonal term. You have some classical sort of problems, stochastic term here, and some precessing term there. And the nuclear decoherence of the nuclear spins we sort of treat phenomenologically. I mean, that's a many-body problem. We don't know what, you can't sort of study that dynamic, so we postulate this kind of the sort of behavior of the correlation function between two different, speed. So this is omega at lambda and omega at lambda prime. There are no correlations between two different species. There are only correlations within the same species, and those correlations decay like a Gaussian. You can argue why this is a Gaussian because of nuclear quadrupole interaction or inhomogeneous broadening. And this time scale that you get from those kinds of arguments, some phenomenological calculation, it matches quite well. Yeah.
So you're right. In the end, you just have three spins.
Yeah, three large spins. Yeah.
And so there are no correlations between the nuclear spins within one species, because if it's all the
same. So within one, there is this correlation. I mean, this we don't calculate. I mean, we postulate this, and this fits the data. If you can do the calculation with this kind of a correlation function, I mean, that's what describes the data. So this, you can argue that this kind of decay can be due to inhomogeneous broadening.
No, I'm not worried about the decay. I'm more worried about slightly more complex dynamics than three collective variables with gradient fluctuations. But so, you're saying that that's sufficient, so that's the problem.
Yeah, I can tell you what the theory does not describe in the data. I will hint at that towards the end of the talk. And probably that has something to do with what you are raising. But from the point of view of this model, this is a completely Gaussian theory with these parameters which you can estimate from other methods and use that to see how far does that experiments. And there's some deviations which I can talk about later. So it's a full, as you said, it's a Gaussian theory, which is very solvable, it's trivial. You calculate the background, and you get an expression, and you know the sweep rate to some, all these parameters are known with some accuracy, you know the sweep rate, you know the sigma square are the sort of hyperfine terms, and the VSO square is VSS square is the spin orbit interaction. All these are measured in the same device because you can measure this Landau-Zener probability, so you know what these parameters are for that device. So you know these parameters to some accuracy, and you can put them and see what your what the theory predicts for the background. So in the absence of spin orbit, you measure the correlation functions. Correlation, the spectral function, you can calculate the spectral function by looking at the correlation functions of the PLZ, and you get peaks at difference of the Larmor frequencies, which is just interference terms between the that's the lowest order effect. And you can calculate the area under the peaks. So when the spin orbit is absent, there are only three peaks because there are three species. So there are three peaks. You see those three peaks, which is the difference of the Larmor frequencies. Those were the vertical lines in the experimental data. They match very well with this. And you can calculate what should be the area under those peaks within this Gaussian theory, and it gives a prediction which is off by a factor of 2 in between the experimental and the theoretical numbers. In the presence of spin orbit, you get 3 additional peaks because of the bare Lamour frequencies, because you have a constant term and the precessing terms. So you get an interference which gives you peaks at the bare Lamour frequencies. You can also predict the areas of that. And it matches reasonably well. There's no analytical expression, but you can basically solve the problem exactly. It's very simple. Do some Gaussian integrals. So here comes the sort of slight mystery, is the data at low frequencies. So if we take this Gaussian form of the correlation function, so that predicts that the correlation function at zero frequency should go to a flatten out. If the Gaussian decay is correct up to the longest times, then you won't see. But the experimental data is suggesting something else. So it says there's a long time tail of some kind in the data, which is not described by this theory.
So that's the 1/f noise that you can't capture by the Gaussian fluctuations?
I mean, I'm not sure if it's not, I don't think it's 1/f either. So I'm not sure if that would describe it. It's some sort of a tail. To be able to tell that kind, you need more experimental data at low frequencies. I mean, you have to go to long. These are limited by the bandwidth of the experimental measurements. I mean, you want to be able to measure. These are 500 sweeps, so say 4 microseconds times 500. You have to go to maybe 5,000 or something to be able to get this correctly without being affected by noise. So at that point, it becomes an experimental challenge to know what this power law divergence is at low frequencies. So this is not due to drift. What we have accounted with, as you're doing the experiment, maybe the sweep rate is drifting. What we think is the sweep rate is not the, what the average sweep rate is not the right, is the right quantity. There's a drift in the sweep rate. We've tried to account for this sort of divergence by taking that drift into account, and that quantitatively doesn't describe it. So there are suggest some residual correlations which are not part of our theory. So this is sort of an open problem to describe in these experiments and do more detailed experiments. The experiments were not aimed at understanding these low frequency properties, and our theory is also not sort of sophisticated enough for that. So that's sort of an open question. There's another question, charge noise. I didn't talk about charge noise. All these devices have a lot of charge noise, which is the major sort of roadblock in fitting the experiments and theory. So high frequency noise you can say something about. There's this work by Kaya Numa where you can study the triplet probability change in the triplet probability, the presence of high frequency noise. The Landau-Zener function is changes to something like this. At large, if you sweep it fast, so high frequency means high compared to the delta, the splitting of the two levels, if it's time scale faster than that. But at large, so if the sweep rate is fast enough, then this expression is the same as the traditional Landau-Zener. So if you expand this, if the sweep rate is fast, then gamma is small, then it gives the same answer as the usual Landau-Zener. So at large, the results are invariant. For a smaller sweep rate, so if you reduce the sweep rate, becomes comparable to the sort of the time scale you take to sweep across the transition, if your sweep rate is the noise is comparable to that time scale, then also you can say something how the peak areas change. Peak areas go down based on a non-linear calculation, which I haven't shown here. Instead of doing the exact calculation, you can learn quite a lot by the non-linear sort of sort of RPA kind of calculation. There you can see if there's noise in the Landau Zener probability, which way the areas will shift. So you can, the areas go down based on that nonlinear sort of, our guess would be. The weight in the background goes up in this regime as well. So that the background and the numerical, the, when we try to fit the theory to the experiments, these are sort of the consistent trends in the experimental data and the theory. So, yeah, so it weakens the height of the loss. So with that, I would like to conclude. So the theory predicts the locations of the peaks in the power spectrum correctly. It captures the areas reasonably well and the background. It is based on a central spin model, which is very simple, but it captures much of the experimental data. So it describes the experimental data quite well, I would say. And it sort of, this work sort of shows that these qubits are very sensitive probes of the nuclear spin environment. Nuclear spins are sort of almost everywhere, but they are sort of silent. I mean, they usually not affect much of the phenomena in the electronic degrees of freedom, but you can probe their dynamics by making these local quantum degrees of freedom and making them very isolated. So they are sensitive to the nuclear spin bath. And the nuclear spins has lots of interesting dynamics to study. So even though the nuclei are at very high temperature, they are coherent. The fact that you see those peaks means that they are coherent. They are coherently evolving amongst each other. So that's, and they're not, and it's, the decoherence times are much longer of the nuclear spin bath. So what this theory does not, as I said, is excess weight as the lowest measured frequency. It suggests some, there is some long time tail in the nuclear spins, which is not captured by this very simple model. And then there's charge noise. If it's charge noise is another set of degrees of freedom which act like a sort of a bath, so to say. Those charge noise, the charge noise could be due to some random two-level systems in your substrate. There could be noise coming in through the gates, hot electrons. There are all these practical issues associated with that, and that requires a much more detailed and sophisticated theory to describe the experiments. With that, I would like to thank you for your attention.
What could be the mechanism where the nuclear spins to be quantum coherent, even though they are at high temperature? What would be the possible?
I mean, they don't have a bath to relax with, basically. I mean, they are sort of isolated many-body interacting system.
But there are many of them.
There are many of them, but. They're interacting, but they're interacting at least on these time scales. The interactions are weak. I mean, you only see the maybe interactions play a role at very long times. That's where the zero frequency, close to zero frequency. I mean, it's a question of time scale. On this time scale, the nuclear spins are not very interacting, I guess. That would be. Question is, if you introduce the interactions between them, you will, the areas, does that describe the areas much better? The areas and the peaks that I showed you, are they renormalized by the interactions in the way which will fit the experiments better? I don't know. Besides the low frequency part. If the finite frequency peaks, the areas are have get contributions from the interaction between them. That it's possible because there's this discrepancy fact between experiments and this theoretical model, at least in this case.
So people often use the central spin model. What does it miss? Because clearly it's somehow it should be incomplete, right? But how could you see experiment, what should you look for?
What?
Because, you know, of course, so wave function of the electron, it's not
everything is coupled to everything.
Constant density, right?
Yeah, it's a decaying Gaussian. So there's that effect. So that effect, we didn't take into account that effect in this model. But that effect plays a role in getting the quantitative, how much the polarization, the difference in the polarization on the two dots. That will depend on the spatial structure of the wave function, because depending on, that will decide every time you flip a spin, where have you flipped the spin, nuclear spin. And there the electronic wave function plays a role. So every time you go, you flip a nuclear spin somewhere, every time you, as I said, flip an electron spin. But where is that nuclear spin flipped? And that is tied to the structure of the electronic wave function.
So they
have done experiments probing that. So they have done experiments probing that by changing the properties of the dot or changing the magnetic field. There are different ways of accessing that, because that is what governs why there's a spin flip in one dot and not the other dot. Right? I mean, why that was one of the mysteries. Like you pump, and if everything is symmetric, the wave functions, they are both identical dots, why does the polarization become so large? Why are you preferentially pumping only one dot? And that is dependent on the structure of the electronic wave function. So if you want to probe the spatial distribution of the nuclear spins, that has to go beyond sort of this kind of simplistic picture.
So this simple spin model is integrable,
right? Yeah, so it belongs to this class of Godin models. I've heard that. I don't know in what sense. So the integrability in the central spin problem.
So what are the integrals of motion in that case?
You can write them down. Godin models are very solid. In the sense you can write down lots of stuff explicitly, which you can't do. So it's a good idea. What?
With Bashan, Emil writes on that explicitly.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's they're not, they're really nice. Yeah. They're not just integral, they're nice.
But they are not free. Are they free fermion integral, or they are still different?
No, they're just.
They're not.
They're related to like Calogero model.
Calogero models.
They're not the same thing, but they're kind of in that spirit effect.
I see, but then if you make couplings different, it goes away, but what does dynamics like in this case?
I think that's interesting.
I don't remember the details, but I recall that, you know, many body, when you have many levels crossing, sort of this kind of a many-body Landau Zener is different than sort of just doing, you know, pairwise Landau Zener.
Yeah.
Kind of one. So
that I don't know.
So here it seems like it's more.
I think it depends on the kind of process you consider. Right? So actually, this one amplitude for the many-body Landau Zener, which you can calculate, and that's amplitude from going from the lowest level initially to the highest one.
Right.
And that's just the pairwise.
Uh-huh.
Just product of pairwise.
Okay.
Crossings.
But there are other amplitudes that are different.
That has not been calculated, but there is some conjecture. So everything they checked it numerically, where essentially you can somehow decompose it into pairwise.
Well, pairwise, I don't know.
I mean, but this one, and maybe the probability to stay have been proven.
What work is this? Whose work is this?
So, I know this work by Shitov.
Shitov, okay.
Around 2003 or so.
Is it Pokrovsky also?
There was also work by Pokrovsky and Simonson.
Yeah, no, it would be interesting.
Because that's what you're assuming it's all pairwise.
It's all pairwise. I mean, yeah, what I think in this regime, I think you don't excite, you don't see, you don't excite the other states at all. I mean, you don't excite. Yeah, you don't go to T's. Yeah, the experiments, they don't seem to measure the other state.
Okay.